The midterm?
Better than expected.
Better than expected? Good. Yeah, I think class length was 92, I think, right? So that's great. I don't understand why, like, some masochistic professors get a kick out of seeing the class average being like a 60 or something. That's like really weird to me. As far as I know, I don't think there's like some departmental thing where you can only get so many A's in a class. At least they didn't tell me anything. So, but seeing a 92, that's like, that makes me very happy. It makes me feel like you guys get it. And I mean, really, if the class average was like a 60, then there's something wrong with me and not with you, right? Cool, so we're officially halfway done. We've gone through all the anatomy, all the cell, all that stuff. So now going forward, you're gonna see recurring themes with all these things that you just crammed into your head, particularly with this one, with vision and visual perception. Since you guys are fresh off of learning what neurons are and neuroconduction and neurotransmission, this lecture has a lot to do with that, so I think you guys won't forget too much from the last few weeks. Just by a show of hands, how many of you guys generally know how we perceive information through our eyes into the brain? Okay, good. So for some of you, this might be a little bit of review, but for the rest of you, this is gonna be a trip, learning out how like we perceive information through the eyes and how this translates into visual imagery. So, let's get started. First, your eyes. We all have them. How do they work though? So the images that we see, just like the images that you're seeing right now on the screen, it all translates down to just a bunch of light that's reflected from the objects that we look at. And somehow your eye, combined with your brain, work together to translate these light reflections into color, into physical objects, and yes, and zoom. Wow, why is it? Oh, wait. Has UCLA been paying their Wi-Fi bill? Let's hold off, just in case. I'll just leech off of iPhone 3's hotspot. Just give me a minute. No, Siri. Okay, so as I said, the images that we see all in front of us, they're just a composition of light that's reflected off objects, and somehow our brain and our eyes work together to translate that information into what we see. Now, just a basic outline of the structure of your eyeball, we have these areas circled in here, which is kind of like the general focus of these next few slides. I'm gonna explain to you what these different parts of the eye do to help you translate that light refractory information. So first, light, if we're looking at an image, enters through the cornea. So the eyeball is composed of this cornea, which is this curved outer lens. We have the light that comes in is controlled by the pupil, which is this kind of narrow opening. It's typically what we see when your eyes dilate, right? And the dilation gives way to the actual lens, which actually, because of its shape, flips and inverts the image that we see. So for example, if we're looking at an R, the image that perceives in our eyeball is actually upside down and reversed. And it's actually our brain that does the work to flip this right side up and uninverted. So this pupil here, you'll notice that there's an iris, and then there's some ciliary muscles that kind of are connected to it, and what these do is they contract and relax to get your iris and your pupil to focus on certain objects or whatever you're trying to look at. And that's what this is, the ciliary muscles. And so if, let's see I'm not missing anything, surrounded by the iris. And then if you remember this guy here, the superior colliculus, that is what controls the amount of light that enters through the pupil. And it's responsible for controlling these muscles here. And so as I mentioned, the light enters through the eye, through the lens, and it gets refracted, so it comes out as an inverted upside down image. Now, other important parts of your eye are the stuff highlighted down here. So first we have the sclera, which is the white part of your eye that we all see, the whites of our eyes. And this is the protective layer that surrounds everything that's inside of the eye. The choroid, which is right also in the back, well, I mean, it surrounds the whole eye, but you can see most pronouncedly here. It's just this thin layer of blood vessels between the retina, which is this back part of the eye, and the sclera. And that is what supplies the eye with blood and all these neurotransmitters and oxygen for it to work. There's the fovea, which is this little, you can't really see it here, but on your slide you may be able to see it. It's like a little indentation. That is very important because this little depression is where your visual acuity is the highest, and I'll explain why in a bit. So whenever you're focused on something, when you align objects to the fovea, that's where the visual sharpness of the object is highest, and this applies to everyone. Now, further in the back here of the eye, there is the optic disc, and you'll notice that there's all these blood vessels spurring inside of the eye. All these blood vessels, they kind of converge into this bundle and they go out in one tract, and that's what's called the optic disc. And then we have the optic nerve, which is this yellow area that's kind of surrounding the optic disc. These are the bundles and bundles of bundles of millions of axons that are leaving the eye and going to your brain. And so we'll see exactly what it's doing, what kind of information it's carrying as it leaves the optic nerve. Any questions on the general eye anatomy so far? Okay, so just a brief overview of visual pathways, and I'll go deeper into like all these different little stops. But generally, how we perceive information is that we see light refracted coming into our retina, right? And the visual pathways, they'll start at the retina here, and then they'll end up at the visual cortex, also known as the occipital lobe, which you guys know what that is. And that's just really the first main stop of it to process basic visual information. There's other pathways that go away from the visual cortex to process more complex information. But generally, the first major stop is the visual cortex. Now, the light that gets received by the retina, by our eye, it gets translated into electrical signal. And then they converge on these ganglion cells, which you can't, it's not marked out here, but these ganglion cells are in the retina, and that's the major output that forms that optic nerve bundle that goes out of the eye. Well, and that's what it says here. And then from there, these bundles of axons will just travel to their respective pathways, directing it towards the appropriate brain centers that process the appropriate visual information. So, as a reminder, what plane of section is this? Right. Good.
What?
So, a couple of other things before we get into the nitty-gritty of how the neurons in our eyes work. We all have a blind spot, similar to, you know, when you're driving and you can't really see like this part or this part of your driving visual surrounding. We all have a blind spot, and it's caused by the optic disc. So the optic disc, as I mentioned, is this area in the back of the eye. So let's see if I can put this into perspective. So you see how there's the optic nerve here, right? This is the optic nerve. So if we zoom into the back of the eye here, this is what we would see. And so in the back, all of these neurons have their axons projecting out and forming like one giant bundle of axons going out. And these cells down here, and I'll explain in a bit, but generally these cells are what picks up the light and transmits that into electrical information. Now, as we know, the eye, when it receives information, has to project to the brain, and it projects through to the brain by this optic nerve. And if you notice, we have all these cells lined up in the back of the retina, right? These red cells, but there's this big gap here because there has to be space for the axons to project out. And that is what our blind spot is. It's due to the lack of these photoreceptors in the optic disc. And we don't really notice this because we have two eyes, and that compensates for some of this. So I'll show you what I mean in this slide. How many of you have done this before? Okay, so for those of you who haven't, or even if you have, I think it's better if you look at the slide on your own screen. But generally, what you would do is put your face close to this slide with your nose positioned right in the middle here. It doesn't have to be like right in front, but just close enough. Now, what you're gonna do is close your left eye, leave your right eye open. With your right eye, look at the cross. Once you do that, start moving your head away from the slide, and you'll notice that the black dot will disappear once you get to a certain point. So again, close your left eye. With your right eye, look at the cross, and then focus on the cross, and then slowly move your head away. How many of you got that? I see some confused faces. So, did you get it? So I think your face is maybe a little bit too close. So yeah, like that. And then close your left eye. Use your right eye to look, focus on the cross. And then move your head back. And you know how you can kind of see the black dot in your periphery?
Oh.
You got it?
Yeah, it went away.
Yeah, you're not focusing. So you're focusing on the cross, but you can kind of see off to the side that the black dot is still there, right? As you move your face away, this black dot will disappear. Okay. So, for those of you who got it, that's exactly what the blind spot is responsible for. So, because our visual acuity does not, that little optic nerve blocks the photoreceptors from, there's no photoreceptors there. Because there's no photoreceptors in the optic nerve, we can't process specific information. Now, the reason why that, no matter how far away you look at these two objects with both eyes, none of them will disappear, and it's because one eye compensates for the other. And that's why you don't miss any of that visual information. And only the blind spot happens when you're relying on a single eye to do that. So your pupils, you guys ever had an eye exam where they dilated your pupils? What was that? Oh, interesting. So, fun fact about that. So, Sienna, right? So Sienna had that done one time where I'm assuming it's at atropine eye drops, and the eye drops came out of her nose.
Yeah.
It's because your so your tear ducts are actually connected to your nostrils.
Yeah.
So that's why when you cry, tears seep in, or actually the tears overflowing actually seep into your nostrils. That's why you get like the runny nose when you cry. Weird fact, but yes, that can happen. So so the reason why these eye exams, they dilate your pupils, right? Like right here, is because these atropine eye drops, they provide an antagonistic, or they antagonize the receptors that are in the back of your eye. And remember, if we antagonize a receptor, it's gonna inhibit, right? It's gonna block those receptors from being activated from other ligands, and so that relaxes the muscles of your pupils, and that's why they expand, and so that way doctors can look directly into the back of your eye and look for any abnormalities. And so this is an actual screen capture of a human retina as if we dilate the pupils and look right in. So this is the back of the eye, and the fovea is that little dip in the back of the eye where your visual acuity is the highest, and then your optic nerve is here. You can see not only all the blood vessels converging, but you can't really see the axons converging, but this convergence is where everything kind of flows out, and that's where your blind spot is. Okay, so more about visual acuity. So if we look at the eye here, right, light comes in, hits the back of the eye, and your blind spot is here again, right, where your optic nerve flows out. There's this little indentation here called the fovea, and the sharpness of vision is best when light coming in is focused in this area. Why is that? So there are three primary reasons, but first, here's a little graph just kind of like showing you the data of that. So on the y-axis, you have a percentage, like how the acuity in terms of 0 to 100, and then on the bottom here is the distance from the fovea, so 0 meaning it's right where the fovea is. So you notice that when light hits further away from the fovea, there's lower visual acuity, but then when it gets closer to the fovea, even when it's right on it, the visual acuity is the highest. And then when the light shines like away or enters further away from the fovea, your visual acuity gets lower until it hits the blind spot where there's no visual acuity, right? Because everything is blocked off. And then it continues as the light enters and kind of scrolls through the back of your retina. So again, there are three primary reasons why visual acuity is the sharpest in the fovea. First reason is because the fovea has an unobstructed view of all the light that's coming in. So if we were to zoom in to the back of the retina, this is the fovea, that little dip. You'll notice that all these cells have their axons kind of swaying away, and this is what's responsible for that dip that you see. Now, so you see this arrow, this is the direction of where light is coming in. So when light comes in, interestingly, if you guys notice, this is the back of the retina. This is the back of your eye. Did you guys notice how the cells are facing away from the light or facing the back of the retina? You would think that the cells would be facing towards the outside of your eye to pick up on the signals, right? But interestingly, the Wi-Fi cut out again. So, oh man. Okay, it's still recording, so I guess. Okay, so interestingly, these cells in your retina are actually facing your retina, so it's pointing away from the light. And all these cell bodies and these neurons and axons are actually transparent. So that's how the light comes in. The neurons don't obstruct any of the light. It actually hits the back of the retina, and that's what hits these cells, and they pick up the information. But because there are no blood vessels and other cell layers that are kind of like impeding the light coming in, you can see that they're all kind of like pushed away. The cells in the fovea have a more direct synaptic connections to the ganglion cells, so because there's less impediment by these other cells, even though they're transparent, the light that's coming in is the most pure, and that's why you have more focus in the fovea. So those are the two reasons. The third reason of why the fovea has the best visual acuity is because there's higher densities of these retinal receptors. And these retinal receptors is what picks up the light and translates that into electrical signal. So there are these cones and rod cells, which I will explain in a bit. But these are the cells that you see here in blue. Those are the cells that's responsible for picking up light. And so there's just a higher density of these cells in the fovea. So if you look at here, this is the same image of the back of the retina that we saw previously. And if we were to zoom in on these cells in the back of the retina, there's a lot more in the fovea compared to when you go further away. Does that make sense? So higher density of these cells, higher visual acuity. Yes?
Is there
any
possible hypothesis that why humans evolved in such
efficient
superior way?
How humans evolved what? In an efficient and varied way?
Inverted.
Oh, inverted way. So in terms of like the image coming in and being refracted and being inverted. So I'm not sure what the evolutionary purpose of that is. It doesn't really make sense, right? But it's not only humans that have that issue where light comes in and image is reverted. All mammals have that same issue. It's just that the brain somehow translates that and reverts it. But yeah, like some things just don't make sense, right? So that's a good question. Okay, so we'll go into visual processing now after we've gone through some of the basic eye anatomy. So visual processing starts at the retina. So again, this is the back of your eye, right? The back of the retina. And the light comes in, and remember how these cells are kind of facing away, which is interesting. So there's several cell types in the back of the retina that's responsible for picking up this information, and these are the rods and cones. These are the red cells that are highlighted here. Now, you'll notice that these are color-coded, which is great. So it shows you that there's at least three types of cells in the back of your eye that relay this information. So there's rods and cones in the red, and they're kind of like mixed in together. There's bipolar cells, which is kind of like the middleman, receives input from these photoreceptors, and then they connect to these yellow cells, which are the ganglion cells. The ganglion cells are the main output of the retina, and you'll notice that the output of these ganglion cells, the axons, become this bundle of axons going out through the optic nerve. So that's kind of like the chain of command. So it hits the photoreceptors, and then it hits the information gets relayed to the bipolar cells, then to the ganglion cells, and then out through the optic nerve. So if we were to zoom in on this little section here in the back of the eye, this is what we would see. So light comes in, right? This is the back of your retina. And so here are these rod and cone cells. So very great. Obvious themes. So rods are these guys that shape like rods, and then cones are these shaped like cones. And both of these have very specific functions, and I'll get into these. But this is just a kind of a zoomed in look of what I was talking about, where these rods and cones, they synapse with these bipolar cell layer. When I say synapse, I mean connects. So if you read the neuroscience literature, you'll hear that a lot. When we say synapse, it just means that they make connections. And then these bipolar cells will synapse onto these ganglion cells, and then you can see that these axons from the ganglion cells will join this bundle of optic nerve fibers going out. There's also two other cell types, the horizontal cells and amacrine cells. You'll notice that most of these cells, they kind of travel in a straight line, but then these horizontal cells are different because they actually connect to the neighboring neurons instead of going straight across. And they play a very, very important role in how you focus light and how colors can contrast on light perception. And we'll go into more detail about what all these do, so you kind of know exactly how it works. So first and foremost, the retina, these two rod and cone cells, right? They're also called photoreceptors. That's like the umbrella term. And rods and cones fall under the category of photoreceptors. So we have this schematic that we saw, the back of the retina, light coming in, right? So these rod cells, these are the most abundant in the periphery of the eye, meaning that the fovea is the center, and everything around it is the periphery. So in the periphery, there are more rods than there are cones. And the rod cell's specific function is that they respond to light. Now, cones are kind of the opposite. Cones are most abundant in and around the fovea, and cones are primarily responsible for color vision. So you have this contrast of light and color information coming in that goes to the brain. And the combination of these two are essential for balancing what you see in terms of how much light, how dark something is, how much focus you have to put into your eyes. And so given that we know that rods are more responsible for light and cones are more responsible for color, what would you say about an animal who has a lot more rod cells than cones? What was your answer? The what? Just that they have more rods. Not necessarily like less cones, but just more rods than usual. Yes. Yeah, exactly. Better vision at night, two answers. So because rods are responsible for perceiving light, the more rod cells you have in your retina, the better you'll be able to respond in low light conditions. So So, for example, nuts. What are some nocturnal animals that we can think of? Raccoons?
No.
They hear mice?
Rats.
Rats and mice are all nocturnal. Owls? That's another good example. So these animals specifically have a lot more rod cells than a typical human would have, because we can't see shit in the dark, right? And they can. Yes? If someone just had rod cells and no cones, that would contribute to black and white, because cones are responsible for color vision. Not necessarily, because rods are mainly response to light, not necessarily to specific monochromatic. Although, you know, we know that the amount of light that we see can change our perception of what a color can be, right? So in a way, rods do contribute a little bit to light, but not to color, but not necessarily monochromatic. And I think I have a slide kind of like explaining this too. So here's just yes, question.
So with color blindness, is it that there's an issue with the individual's cones, or is that something like the visual processing in the brain?
It can be both.
Okay.
It can be both. So you can have a malfunction. So the question was, for someone who is colorblind, is there a specific issue with their cones? Or issue in the brain processing, and it could be both, because if you have a malfunction in your cone, you can't really process color to begin with. But if your cones are fine and you go, the signal travels to your occipital lobe and the appropriate processing centers, if you have, for example, brain damage that just so happens to be in an area where it processes color, then you can have an issue with that too. And we know that color blindness is graded, right? There's different levels of it, so that can also explain why. It can be both ways. Good question. So this is an electron microscopy photo of an actual rod and cone, just so you can get an idea of how accurate they look. Even though this cone looks a little limp, which is kind of interesting. But that's exactly how they look like in the human retina, just to give you an idea. So yeah, this is the slide I was referring to. So photoreceptors, they can adapt, obviously, right? Because light changes constantly throughout the day. And so these photoreceptors are very sensitive to light, regardless if it's rods or cones. And so each photoreceptor has a really wide range of perceiving light. And so here we have a chart where cones are most active, and then rods are most active. So here, we see the same image of this rose. So if we were to go outside right now and look at some flowers, we'd probably see something like this, where the light kind of blasts our image, right, of what we're perceiving. And so these cones are more active at higher light levels. And so as we go down in terms of the light intensity throughout the day, we can see that the threshold for perception of color, bright moonlight, like in the dark, that's where kind of like rods kick in the most. And so that corresponds with kind of like the images that we see here, where there's less light. And it's the rods that are responsible for kind of being more involved in the darkness. And that's why we see nocturnal animals who have like more rods have better vision in the dark, because this is obviously something that we humans would see. If we had more rods, we would be better able to adjust to the dark and maybe see something a lot brighter in the dark. Yeah. So to my knowledge, we are born with a certain number. Obviously, cells can grow and change, but not as fast. These photoreceptors can't adapt as fast as like other forms of neuroplasticity, because you can see that there's a pretty complex chain of command in the retina. So, yeah.
Just curious about
LED panels. Yeah, because of the bright light. It's pretty much like, actually, because LED panels, they're they're uniformly bright, right? Right, so certain LEDs in the LED panel can be cut off to highlight the contrast. Yeah, and so your question in relation to that would be?
In that case,
we're
both,
Oh, I see what you're saying. Because there's a mix of like light and dark in the LED panel.
It's also very bright, but it's also really high
contrast. Ah, yeah, that's a good question. So both would be active. Again, it's like a graded response, right? Because the darker it gets, the more rod cells kind of kick in. So there's like a medium. There's not really like a on-off kind of thing. As I'll explain in the later slides, there's something called lateral inhibition, where, I don't want to spoil it, but it's the fact that these two kind of like work together to kind of help with color contrast and light contrast. Okay, so how do these photoreceptors work? So this is a very important concept that you guys are kind of exposed to already, like with how neurons depolarize or hyperpolarize. Now, because the brain, of course, gets a little more complex, these photoreceptors, you know, in itself are neurons, but they work a little differently than the simplified examples that I gave on the first few weeks of this class. So, if you remember, I think the example I brought up about like ligands and receptors and how some ligands can have inverse agonist effect, right? Where it depends on what the receptor is actually doing first. Some receptors might be like kind of open all the time and firing, right? Compared to the basic example I showed you guys, like the receptor is always on or off. So these are more like the other kind of a neuron, where it has calcium and sodium channels, and these are constantly on. So it's kind of in contrast to what we've been dealing with, where receptors are always on or off. These are constantly on. And so how these cone cells work, it's very different. So let me walk this through. So these two panels show the chain of synapses from the rod cell to the bipolar cell to the ganglion cell that goes right to the eye. This is when your eye is in the dark. This is when your eye is like in a light environment. So let's talk about in the dark first. So in the dark, these rod cells, they are constantly letting calcium and sodium in because it's responding to darkness. So we know that when there are constant influx of positive ions, then that moves, right, the neuron closer to threshold to firing action potentials. And so in the dark, these rods are always firing action potentials. Let that sink in for a little bit. In the darkness, these rod cells will get triggered to let calcium and sodium in, right? When we have a lot of calcium and sodium coming in, the neuron's threshold gets higher and higher to be more positively charged, thereby firing action potentials. So these rods in the dark are always firing action potentials. Now, the signal travels down, as we know, right, through a greater potential. And then right here on the terminal are our friends' voltage-gated calcium channels, right? We know that when the signal conduction travels down the axon, when it reaches the axon terminal, then it's we have these voltage-gated calcium channels that when triggered, calcium flows in the terminals. That triggers exocytosis to release neurotransmitters. The specific neurotransmitter that these retinal photoreceptor uses is glutamate. So when it releases glutamate onto the bipolar cells, the binding of glutamate to the receptors here in the bipolar cells actually shut the bipolar cells down. It inhibits it. So you could think of glutamate as like acting like a brake for the bipolar cells. So when glutamate releases, it binds to a specific glutamate transmitter, a glutamate receptor that inhibits the cell, or as we know, IPSP, right? So it inhibits the bipolar cells, preventing the bipolar cell from firing. And if it doesn't fire, it doesn't release any neurotransmitters. And therefore, the ganglion cell doesn't get activated. Does that make sense? Yes. Yeah. Yeah, and of course, glutamate is normally excitatory, but then there's a host of different glutamate receptors that can have inhibitory or excitatory effects. Question?
So the photoreceptor is firing, is always firing action potentials, but there's also a graded potential. Like, how are those?
Oh yeah. So yeah. So the it's as the calcium goes in, it produces the graded potential, and then when it reaches the cell body, then that produces the action potential to go down to trigger the calcium, voltage-gated calcium channels.
Okay,
yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Thank you.
So does that make sense? Yes?
This applies to rods and cones.
This applies to rods and cones, but given this, you know, it's a light and dark example, it's better explained by the rods. Yeah. Yeah?
So the more light there is for the rods,
no, the more light there is, the more the ganglion cells will be activated. So if I walk through this again, so just to make things clear, this is good because I want you guys to get this. So, well, let's just focus on this dark panel here, right? We have these rod cells does not pick up any light because we're in a dark environment. It's because these rods respond to darkness more, in the dark, there will always be this, it triggers this influx of positively charged ions going in, right? That creates a graded potential, pushing it more positively charged, and once it reaches the hillock here, it's not marked, but here, that's what generates the action potential. And when that happens, right, it travels down the axon to the terminal where it'll trigger these voltage-gated calcium channels. When we trigger voltage-gated calcium channels, that triggers exocytosis, meaning the release of neurotransmitters. In this case, it's glutamate. Now, when glutamate is released to the bipolar cell, the receptors on this bipolar cell will have an inhibitory effect with glutamate. So meaning, when glutamate binds to the bipolar cell, it's going to shut down the bipolar cell. It's going to prevent it from firing. And if the bipolar cell is not firing, that means it's not going to release any neurotransmitters to activate the ganglion. That's happening in the dark, which makes sense, right? Because we don't really see anything in the dark. We don't perceive anything in the dark. Does that make sense? Yeah? I know it's kind of like blasphemous to what I've been like teaching you before, but yeah.
So now I'm a little bit confused again. Where are the graded potentials?
Yeah, so the graded potential are, so I know normally, in the other examples we've shown, in any other neuron, like a normal neuron that's not a freaking photoreceptor, the graded potentials are generated from inputs from other cells, right? This, these graded potentials are generated by light or dark.
At the same time as the action.
So the action potential triggers right here in the cell body. Remember how in the dendrites receive all the inputs and all the graded potentials travel to the axon hillock? And at the axon hillock is where all the graded potentials accumulate? Summation, and if it pushes it over the threshold, then it triggers the first action potential, which would be like right here, and it'll travel down this axon here.
So the graded potential is caused by the positively charged ion.
Yes.
And there are always an excitatory direction. So
yes, because there's no light coming in, and no light triggers positively charged ions going in. So that's a good point that you brought up. So it's the exact same concept as we've talked about with EPSPs and IPSPs, except that with these photoreceptors, EPSP and IPSPs are not generated by other neurons' input. It's generated by light or dark. And these photoreceptors are sensitive to the light or dark, and that's what translates that input to like calcium ion and calcium and sodium ions. Does that make sense? Yeah.
No,
resting potential is always negative. But this one, it's always firing. It's always firing, so it's always above the resting potential.
What is it activated by?
It's activated by light or dark.
It's not receiving
So it, because, remember, because if because it's neural communication within the cell, it's done by ions, right? It's done by electrically charged ions. These are very, very special types of cells that we don't see anywhere else. So this is the pretty much one of the only cases where it's not input from other neurons that trigger these EPSP or IPSPs. It's light or dark. Does that make sense? Yeah?
Is the like text on the slide referring to what happens in the light?
What, this or this?
Like the text on the left side of the screen, is that describing what happens when it's in light condition?
Oh, yes. This is what responsible for what happens in the light condition.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, because depolarization is what these cells are always going through. They're always firing action potentials because the inside of the cell is getting always getting more positively charged because there's always positively charged ions coming in, triggered by the dark. I think I saw another hand back there. Okay. Cool. Okay. Yes.
So wait, so the calcium and sodium channels, they're light-gated? So
yeah, they're light-sensitive. So this is very similar to what we briefly talked about with optogenetics, right? So remember, optogenetics, they have these this light-sensitive ion channels. That's essentially what these are. They respond to light. So that's good. Thanks for pointing that out. Does that make sense? We can take as long as we want going over this. I know it's kind of confusing. Okay, so now let's get into what happens in the light. So again, these rod cells, they respond to light, right? They're light sensitive. Now, when we are in an environment where there's light, it's actually gonna close these ion channels. So no more sodium or calcium will flow in, meaning the inside of the cell will be more negatively charged, right? Because in the dark, a lot of positive ions are flowing in, meaning the inside of the cell will be more positive, increasing the likelihood for action potentials. In the light, if no positive ions are flowing in, then the inside of the cell will remain at its resting memory potential, meaning negatively charged. So because it doesn't reach any threshold, there's no gradient potential that travels down. The voltage-gated calcium channels at the axon terminal don't get activated, and there's no glutamate release. Now, when there's no glutamate release, the bipolar cell, it's free to do whatever it wants now. So remember, glutamate acts like a brake for these bipolar cells. When there's glutamate being released, the bipolar cells has to stop doing what it's doing. Because normally, the bipolar cells also constantly fire action potentials and constantly release neurotransmitters. So because there's no glutamate release, that means the brakes are off. Yeah?
Okay, so I guess I'm confused on how this would aid perception then, because assuming that there's no glutamate release and the bipolar cell is firing, mm-hmm. I guess our brain just assumes that there's brightness and it conveys that okay, there's light coming in. But like, how would you be able to perceive like different levels of brightness or darkness or shades if it's only just a binary signal?
Ah, good question. So this is also a graded response too, just like how these graded potentials are. So the channels here, it's not really like all or none because these aren't action potential voltage gated channels, right? Because they are resting membrane potential ion channels, it's kind of like a graded response. So if there's less light, then these will respond more. These are not all or none, is what I'm trying to say.
So if there's less light, it'll still fire an action potential, it'll just be weaker?
Yeah, it'll just be weaker, and ultimately less neurotransmitters released.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm sorry for continuing.
No, not at all.
But your response to a previous question was that more light equals more activation of the ganglion cells?
Right.
When you say light shuts down the ganglion, doesn't activate the bipolar cells, and therefore doesn't activate the ganglion cells?
No, so the very last part of that is what I was going to get to.
Okay.
No, it's okay. It's okay. This is great because it's. I like that this is a discussion and not just like me talking. So to get to that, so where I left off, if there is no glutamate being released to the bipolar cells, that means the brakes are off. And the bipolar cell will, because there's no brake, it's going to release neurotransmitter, thereby activating the ganglion cells to transmit that signal. Does that make sense? So it's very polar opposite effect. And when we get to like more complex examples of how these neurons work, there are like these bipolar cells where their main function is always being on, as opposed to the cells that we've been talking about, where okay, basic examples like their cells are off and they have to be turned on via an action potential or neurotransmitter. But does this make a little bit more sense? Yeah. Yeah, so the bipolar cells are always on, and that's because they have a constant influx of, well, so under normal conditions, they're always on. They have a constant influx of positive ions flowing in. And it's because of this glutamate that acts as the brake that tells them that when it binds, it stops that process and shuts the bipolar cells down. Yeah, the channels are always open. Uh-huh. It's really dependent on the glutamate coming from the photoreceptors. That makes sense? Yeah. Cool. Yeah?
So then when the bipolar cells are not inhibited, they release neurotransmitters that then depolarize or activate the ganglion cells.
Exactly.
They would be APSP?
Yes, that's right. So the question was when these bipolar cells get the brakes released from no glutamate coming in, they are able to release neurotransmitters, and then that in turn activates the ganglion cell and transmits the signal. Yeah.
So in the picture, you say that glutamate is excitatory.
Yeah. So the overall effect of glutamate is excitatory. But there are, just like, remember how we talked about dopamine, right? It depends on the receptor. There's different dopamine receptor subtypes where like the D1 family is excitatory, D2 family is inhibitory. It's the same concept with glutamate. There are subsets of glutamate receptors that have an excitatory effect. Some have an inhibitory effect. And it's those inhibitory glutamate receptors that are on this bipolar cell. So when glutamate binds to those inhibitory glutamate receptors, it's going to inhibit the bipolar cell from firing, and thereby does not trigger the ganglion cell. Yeah. Did you saw another hand? Yeah. Hold on. Let me walk over. So the question is, should you know like each step of this? I would know the general process, right? Like in the dark, there's calcium ions flowing in, and then what the chain of command, like, okay, if there's calcium flowing in here, what happens to the bipolar cell? Yeah, both in the light and in the dark. That's pretty important. All right. Yeah. Yeah, so the question is this the same process for rod cells, because they respond to color? And yes, it is the same, because I'll have the information on a further slide. Color is perceived in wavelengths. So because it's wavelengths of light, that's why cones are able to respond to that and interpret color. I have a slide on like what how light is perceived on a spectrum. Wavelengths, but is that good? Yeah? Okay, so aside from these photoreceptors, there are other cell types in the retina, as I kind of mentioned, right? Just to orient you, this here will be the back of the retina, right? Because these cones and rods are facing it, and then the light is coming in from this way, right? From this way up. And so we talked about photoreceptors already, which are the rods and cones. Now there's also these horizontal cells here, labeled in H, right here. And then these amacrine cells in labeled in A here. And then the green cells in B, these are the bipolar cells that we just talked about. So one interesting feature is that you'll notice that these amacrine and horizontal cells, they kind of connect with their neighboring neurons to the side instead of across. And this has a very important function because it helps regulate the activity of these photoreceptors. You remember what I said that, you know, it's a graded response with these photoreceptors, depending on the amount of light that you see. These cells help a lot with regulating that. Otherwise, you would just be blinded by light all the time, really. This also helps with the color contrast and all these other things, too. So the important distinction is that these horizontal cells, they receive input from the photoreceptors and the bipolar cells on this end. On the other end are the amacrine cells, which receive input from the bipolar and to reach the ganglion cells. So these two kind of like work independently of each other. Horizontal cells only appear on this side by the photoreceptors. Amacrine cells serve the same purpose, but they're just on the other side of the spectrum. So this is same schematic as before, but an actual microscopic section of a human retina. So you can see, if you remember some of the methods with anatomical staining, this is a good example of that. So here we have these photoreceptors. They're all in green, which is this. And then we have the soma of the bipolar cell, which is this, stained in yellow. And then we have these ganglion cells kind of in the back here, which are these guys here. So this is how they actually look. And as you can grab from this image, it gets very complicated because there's so many of these guys in the back of the retina. Okay. So amacrine and horizontal cells, I mentioned that they play a very important role in helping contrast light. And they do that by a process called lateral inhibition. So what this is that you can see here, we have our eyeball, right? We have both light and dark stimulus coming in, right? And then here are the photoreceptors that are responding to that. Here are the amacrine cells or horizontal cells, and this is a very simplified schematic. And these connect with the ganglion cells, and that forms to the optic nerve, right? So what this idea of lateral inhibition is, if you notice here on the graph down here is a chart, y-axis is the rate of firing or rate of action potentials, and then here are the positions of the ganglion cell. So this dot represents the ganglion cell number one, this dot number two, this dot number three, and this dot number four. So we have this kind of like dual stimulus coming in where one side is light and one side is dark. And you can kind of orient yourself to this. So when we look at these bars, they are actually uniform in color, right? Each bar is uniform in color, but you'll notice that usually like the left, like if we look at the second gray bar here, this left edge looks a little lighter than the right edge. Do you guys see that? Or maybe on your screens, you could probably see that. The other example is right here in B, this stack of cubes. The top and the bottom, who thinks they are the same color? Who thinks the top and bottom are different colors? So I don't blame you for thinking they're different because of lateral inhibition, but if you were to like use your finger and cover this middle section, you'll see that both the top and the bottom are indeed the same shade of gray. So why is that? Like, clearly, if you look at this, the top looks darker than the bottom, right? And it's because of lateral inhibition. So this has to do with contrasting edges. So we'll take this color bar as an example. So if we were to take like this color bar and we review it through the retina, we'd have like one side that's light and one side that's dark, right? And so these photoreceptors, they, for example, they respond to light, so there's more firing here. So more activation of these lateral amacrine and horizontal cells will actually inhibit their neighbors. Remember how horizontal and amacrine cells, they're kind of unique in that they synapse with their neighboring neurons instead of across, what you see here. So for example, if cells 3 and 4 are getting more activation because it's responding to the light, you can see the rate of firing is higher, this will trigger these amacrine and horizontal cells to inhibit the neighbors. So you can see that cells 3 and 4 have a higher rate of firing, but then you see this stark contrast between cells 1 and 2 where the rate of firing is much lower. And because of this decrease in rate of firing, it enhances the contrast between the two. Does that make sense? That is why when you look at this, you'll see that, even though these are sort of the same color, but because the edges are, they look a little different, it kind of enhances the contrast to make it look like there's two different shades of gray. That's also the reason why when you look at like this bar, like here in the second gray bar, the left edge may look a little lighter, whereas the right edge may look a little darker. Right? So when you're perceiving more light, it's going to inhibit the other neighboring neurons to make the other visual stimulus look darker, like increase the contrast. Does that make sense? So these neurons aren't always just like straight firing, right? There's these horizontal and amacrine cells that kind of regulate the activity of their neighboring neurons to enhance contrast, to improve your visual acuity. Does that make sense? Okay, now we're getting even more complex with receptive fields. Oh, did I turn that off? I did turn that off. Does this work, or does everyone like the darker? Okay, more rod activity. Gotcha. There we go. Okay, so receptive fields. So as I mentioned, there's a whole lot of photoreceptors in the back of our retina. So they really look more like this, all kind of bunched up together instead of like equally spaced apart. And so the receptive field are all of these rods and cones that kind of converge onto a bipolar cell and then onto a ganglion cell. So they're all kind of like connected to multiple horizontal and multiple bipolar cells, and that's how it regulates light contrast. So if we were to look at this, we have something called a center and a surround for these receptive fields, meaning that obviously they're not color-coded like this, but just for the sake of this example, these are color-coded. Imagine that there's a circular area in which these photoreceptors are specific to a certain object that you're looking at. This is the receptive field, and so receptive fields have an on and an off section. So again, this is just a half circle. This is actually typically a full circle, what you see here, but they just cut it in half just so you can see. So what we mean by that, for example, if there is an on field, it means that these photoreceptors are triggered by a stimulus, whereas the other surrounding can be off, which is actually inhibited by light. A little confusing, I know. But let me get to the next slide where I'll get more into this. So this is a better representation of what you just saw. So here, right, we have all these different cones and rods and receptors here, and they all have these horizontal cells connecting to each other, and then a bipolar cell, and then a ganglion cell, which goes out to the brain, right? So you notice that there's two circles here. There's a center and then a surround. That's what you see here. So in this specific example, in A, we have this receptive field with an on-center and an off-surround. On-center meaning the white space, the center, is on, meaning that when you shine a light on, or light, when light comes in and hits the on-center, it's going to turn on those photoreceptors, those neurons. So you can see that when light shines on the middle, right? Light comes in, it moves the cell to being more positively charged, and then all these action potentials happen, more so than normal, right, within this yellow block. Now, this is the surround of this receptive field is off, and so if you were to shine a light on the off surround, it would actually inhibit those photoreceptors, right? And then less action potentials would happen. So keep in mind that these ganglion cells, this is what it's representing. The ganglion cells here, these are always firing action potentials, and so when you see that the light is shining on the surround, which is off, it inhibits it, and there's less action potentials going out to the ganglion cell and to the brain. Now, what happens if you were to just blast the entire receptive field with light, putting a light on both the surround and the on center and the off surround? Well, you would have a somewhat normal effect, which doesn't really translate to more action potentials, as you see here. Does that make sense? It's a whole collection of these photoreceptors, and because of the whole lateral inhibition concept, it generates to the center being more responsive than the surrounding photoreceptors. Yeah?
In like normal life,
so light does, but it's graded, remember? Depending on what you're focusing on, right? Because if you're focusing on, like, for example, here, like in the white space, yes, right? There's a lot more light. So let's say if you're focusing more on like the out space here where there's like a lot of dark space, then there's less light. So it's like less being flooded. So it depends on like what you're focusing on actually. The object that you're looking at, yeah. Yeah, because everything that we look at, it's really just light bouncing off of this object, and it's the light that we're picking up. So that's what that is. Yeah? There are lots and lots and lots. Yeah, there are because we know that there are billions of axons of these ganglion cells going out, right? And so there are multiple photoreceptors connected to like a single bipolar and a single ganglion cell. So there's a lot more photoreceptors. I mean, exactly. Also, differs by that too. So, yeah, does that make sense? These are just very like simple examples. If we were to actually look at the retina's receptive fields, a lot of these would be kind of bundled up together and overlap. So it can get very, very complex in terms of how you perceive light. Yeah?
So on the previous slide, it had said that glutamate depolarizes some bipolar cells but hyperpolarizes others depending on the type of glutamate receptor. So
yeah.
Is it like there's different receptors in the surround than in the center, and that's why light does different things to each one?
So not that there's different receptors in the light and surround. It's the different horizontal and amacrine cells that affect the center and surround. So for example, like you have, let's say this is an on center, right? So if light shines in the center, the on center, just like this example, this will generate an action potential from here, and then releasing glutamate onto the bipolar, and then the signal will travel down, right? But because these amacrine cells are connected, and there's more stimulation out in the center, it's going to inhibit, through lateral inhibition, inhibit the surrounding photoreceptors.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
A little bit, yeah.
So. It does depend on glutamate receptors, but this process of receptive fields, it actually depends a lot more on these horizontal cells, because if one of them is being activated, as I mentioned in the previous slide, it's gonna inhibit its neighbors.
Okay. Yeah, that makes more sense.
Okay. So what I mentioned about like the glutamate and the receptors turning on hyperpolarizing or depolarizing cell, that kind of just applies to like this one chain of command down, but then when you introduce the horizontal and amacrine cells, that kind of complicates things a little bit, because that also goes into play into which cell gets hyperpolarized and which doesn't.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes.
I guess I'm confused now, kind of following up on that, because if the center, the on center is releasing glutamate, shouldn't that deactivate the bipolar cell, correct? Shouldn't it put the brakes on the bipolar cell and not send a signal?
Right. It should, but we have other processes that are in play here. Compared to that, even though that example that I showed was like pretty simple, it actually does get a little bit more complex. Okay. So again, so this schematic doesn't show the amacrine cells that are down here.
I see.
Okay. So these are horizontal cells. Let me go back a little. Right, so we have the horizontal cells that you saw in that schematic, which are connected to the photoreceptors, but then you have these amacrine cells down here that also synapse onto not only the bipolar, but also the ganglion cells. So this also has a role in determining if the ganglion cell ultimately turns on or off.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. Yes?
I'm also a little confused.
Mm-hmm.
So the light, when it hits the on center, then it excites the bipolar cells and the ganglion cells fire, but then it hits the surround and inhibits it. Is that because of lateral inhibition?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That's why we have these receptive fields. The surround is due to lateral inhibition. Now, the opposite thing can happen. So this is what we just talked about when a receptive field has an on-center and an off-surround. But what about the other case? So here in B, we have the opposite, an off-center and an on-surround. So just like you'd expect, the opposite thing would happen. If the center is off, meaning when we shine a light on the center, it's going to inhibit the cell, right? So the cell will be more negatively charged. There will be less action potentials. When we shine a light on the on-surround, it's going to activate those photoreceptors and more action potentials. So the inverse would happen if we were looking at an off-center on-surround. Questions? Okay, enough of that. So now we'll go into a bit more broader stuff now with visual field in humans. So remember how I talked about that we all have this blind spot with that test, but we can only see it when we cover one eye. And when we look at, when we have bifocal vision, it compensates and fills in the rest. So that has to do with the visual field of our eyes. So the visual field is pretty much the entire area that you can see without moving your head and eyes, just like what you're seeing right now. And so when we talk about something that's more nasal, we mean something that's closer to the nose, and that's going to come in handy when we talk about these optic tracts. Temporal just means closer to your temporal lobe, so kind of like laterally as opposed to medial. So how this works is that we both have a left and right visual field, right? Because we have left and right eyes. And so this whole thing, this whole semicircle is a visual field of both eyes combined together, which is why we can see this whole field, right? But let's talk about like our right visual field, which is here. So everything coming from the right side that we're seeing is picked up by the temporal side of our left eye and the nasal side of our right eye. So you can see that if light is coming in this direction, it's going to hit this side of the retina, right, in blue. The opposite of that, the left visual field, right, if the light is coming from the left side, it's going to hit the opposite wall of the retina on both eyes. Does that make sense? So red hits red, blue hits blue. So once these signals get picked up by the retina, right, output through the ganglion cells, they will converge here at the optic chiasm. I think that's the left. So ultimately, that's what happens. We pick up things from the visual field on kind of the opposite wall of the retina for both eyes. And so each eye has two split hemi fields, right? Meaning this is what I just explained here. So the right visual field will hit the left side of both eyes. Left visual field will hit the right side of both eyes, and vice versa. So because of that, does this make sense to you guys? Right? Because our like one eye doesn't just pick up everything. It kind of picks up everything that, or mostly everything that, that comes out through this one side. And so it's not until when all this output converges is when it travels to the back of the brain and we are able to get a composition of the full image. And so once the retina, the photoreceptors, picks up these signals and then it outputs through the ganglion cells through the optic nerve, as you see here, it's going to converge at the optic chiasm, these ganglion cells. And this is the point where all of the visual information from one side will converge and go into the respective direction. So let's look at the right visual field, right? So light comes in, it gets picked up on the temporal side of the left eye and the nasal side of the right eye, so it's in blue. So the information here will travel out through the optic nerve. Once it gets here, it's going to cross over. So all the stuff from seen by the right eye or the right So all the stuff that gets picked up on this side of the retina and this side of the retina will converge and come together. And then that information will travel together to on this side to the visual cortex or the occipital lobe. And so once they converge, it becomes the optic tract because all of the correct visual information from these visual fields will travel together now. And this is the optic tract. So if we're looking at this side, all the information picked up on the left visual field here in red will travel out and then cross, this one will cross over to the opposite side forming the optic tract. So now all of that visual information will travel together and go to the occipital lobe. So this is our visual field, right? We won't really see about a little bit more than 180 degrees of what's in front of us. So when we see in prey species, their visual field is a little different. So because of the orientation of their eyes and their retina, they have almost a 360 degree visual field. So why would you think that is an advantage? Or why do you think that is? Yeah. What was that? Exactly. So the advantage of these species having an almost 360 degree visual field is so that they can see prey coming from all around. It's a survival mechanism, or evolutionary survival mechanism. Okay, so in terms of how the visual pathways travel, so when we perceive an image, and these numbers correspond to the numbers on the schematic here, we have light that enters through the eye, right, and it reverses the image. That information gets picked up by the photoreceptors, which goes out through the optic nerve, and so it's going to carry this visual information until it reaches the optic chiasm, where these optic tracts will converge and the same information will travel on their respective sides. Now, it's important to note that stuff that's picked up on the left visual field gets processed in the opposite side of the brain. So that's why you see the red crossing over and going to that side, and the blue crossing over and going to that side. And so, again, once they cross over and all these bundles of axons converge together, that is what forms the optic tract here, and they travel together. And so, once they converge into the optic tract, it kind of makes its first pit stop before hitting the occipital lobe. So you guys remember the thalamus, how it serves as kind of like a relay station? This is one of the purposes it serves. It relays visual information out to the respective regions. So once they form the optic tract, the first stop will be in the lateral geniculate nucleus of the thalamus. And then this is where most of the visual information will then travel to the occipital cortex or the occipital lobe, and then some will end up in the superior colliculus to either process or integrate information to kind of adjust your eyes and focus on certain objects. Step number five, axons from the lateral genicular nucleus will then, as I mentioned, send its information to the occipital lobe through what's called the optic radiations. The optic radiations are what you kind of see, well, we'll see in the next slide, but it's pretty much the occipital lobe, and it has this kind of like very laminar organization, so it looks like it's striped, and those stripes process different types of information in your occipital lobe. So in terms of the ganglion cells, when it projects out from the lateral geniculate nucleus, there's two types. There's small ganglion cells, and then there's large ganglion cells. And they have very specific functions too. So the small ganglion cells, they mainly receive input from single cones, and then they go into the lateral geniculate nucleus of thalamus and to discriminate color. The larger ganglion cells receive input from more cones, and these project to another layer of the lateral geniculate nucleus, which cannot discriminate color, and I'll explain why. So in the lateral geniculate nucleus, there's these two distinct layers, the parvocellular and the magnocellular layer. And it looks like a stripe organization, as you'll see here. So in this coronal section, we have the thalamus here. The lateral geniculate nucleus is part of the thalamus, and if we were to zoom in, it actually looks like this, where some layers are darker and some layers are lighter. So the parvocellular layer, which are the four dorsal layers, right, the four outer layers, which is layers 3 to 6, these are the ones with small receptive fields. And then the magnocellular layer, which are the two ventral layers, the two inner layers, 1 and 2, these have much more larger cells, which can process a lot more information. Does that make sense? Okay, so once this information reaches the occipital lobe, how exactly does the brain process or recognize these images? So aside from the lateral geniculate nucleus, the relay station, the first big stop is the primary visual cortex, also known as V1, or as you guys have been known to associate this by, is the occipital lobe. So this is a mid-sagittal section of the brain. So this is the anterior, and this is the posterior, and this is just a reverse image of that. So the occipital lobe is here, and this is also known as V1, and this is what, it's really the medialmost regions, and this is what the first stop of all the visual information from your eyes makes its processing point. And interestingly, when you're asked to form, like, think of mental images, this, your occipital lobe also activates. So it's definitely responsible for all things visual, at least the major things. So again, realizing the question, how does the signal coming in from our retina translate to images? So early research, this was done in anesthetized cats back in like the early 60s and 70s. They don't do that anymore. This was like way before Iacuc was a thing. So what they did was they recorded neurons, single neurons, from the visual cortex of cats, visual cortex being the occipital lobe. And what they did was they had the cat look at a screen that showed different bars in different orientations. So, for example, this bar is horizontal, this bar is a little bit diagonal, a little bit more until it's complete vertical, and it just basically rotates 360 degrees. The point of this was to see how individual neurons in the occipital lobe responds to shapes or objects. Like, how is it that we can translate what we see into perception? And so if you look at this line here, this is just like across time. And this top bar here is when the orientation of this bar is at this point. And then this little vertical line is in action potential. So if you just kind of look all the way down across, you can see almost like a graded response. Graded meaning that there's more action potentials as the shape gets to a certain point. So if you notice, This diagonal shape elicits like one action potential, but then as the sheep rotates more and more, there's more action potentials until this particular neuron responds very specifically to bars that are in a complete vertical position. And then as the bar continues to rotate, the action potentials diminish. Now this is another in panel B. This section is pretty much the same experiment, but they did this in monkeys. Same looking at single neurons in the visual cortex, and the same experiment where you have these rotating bars, and you can see that this specific neuron responds mostly to when it sees a bar that's in this diagonal shape. So what does this tell us? This suggests that neurons in our visual cortex respond to specific orientations of shapes. Right? That's what this data shows, because all this is from a single neuron, and this particular neuron that was recorded responds specifically or mostly to shapes that are vertically oriented. This neuron recorded in the monkey in the visual cortex responds preferentially to bars that are oriented in this position. So this gave us kind of, it's one of the earliest ideas that suggested that neurons in our visual cortex maybe respond more to shapes. And it's a collection of these neurons that respond to different shapes, and that's what makes us interpret these objects in the brain. Any questions about this schematic? So, there were other theories of how we interpret visual information, and one of them is the hierarchical model of vision, and this has a lot to do with the on-center, off-surround receptive fields. So the idea is that, and this is related to the whole bar thing that we just saw on the previous slide. So we have these three receptive fields here, right? And then we have the bar of light that we saw on the previous slide. So let's say that we have receptive fields that pick up on the bars that have orientations diagonal like this. That is gonna trigger these receptive fields to turn on and then turn on this ganglion cell, and then that projects through the visual pathways to the visual cortex, and that's what makes us recognize, oh, it's a bar orienting this way. So if you combine that, if we have multiple bars moving across the screen, then we're gonna have different receptive fields that respond to this kind of bar orientation, and that's what triggers these cells to project out to the brain. Does that make sense? It's a combination of what we saw here with cells responding to specific bars of orientation and the receptive fields that we talked about. So that's one theory of how we are able to process this visual information. And these are also known as feature detectors, right? We're detecting features by these receptive fields. But there are some problems with this because we don't just perceive all objects by shapes, by bars, right? So there are other more complex theories that came about. Another one is called, the spatial frequency filter model, which instead of cells responding to specific bars or objects, this theory suggests that our cells are more tuned to spatial frequency. What is spatial frequency? So here are a set of grids varying in bar width and visual acuity, right? You'll notice that here on A, there's a lot less bars, but there's more of them. But then here, there's thicker bars, and here, the line starts to blur, right? So what spatial frequency refers to is that if there's more bars, then that means there's a higher spatial frequency. It takes up more space. Yeah?
It feels like you hypothesis theories all assume that we all have the same or similar receptor field within the same species.
So that's a good question. So the question was that these theories assume that we all have the same receptive fields across species. And that in part is a pretty logical assumption, But overall, because of the differences in the number of rods and cones across species, we do indeed have different purposes here. Does that make sense? And again, this was like really early work. This was like super early work. So as time goes on, we see that the theories get more complex to take into account the cave, or your theory didn't really take into account that we all have different receptive fields. And so so the idea with here is that if there's more spatial frequency, then certain cells will respond more to that. So what do I mean? So here's a better example of this. So the visual system have like these multiple channels that are tuned to different spatial frequencies, meaning some cells respond to lower frequency objects, some respond to higher frequency objects. And so when we, the problem that the other theory didn't address was, right, we don't really look interpret things in terms of bars, right? Things like faces are pretty complex. And so that's what this theory tries to account for, is that in terms of more complex stimuli, certain cells can break down the spatial frequency components in order to recognize these objects. So for example, here we have a normal image of two penguins. Here we have the high frequencies filtered out. Right? High frequencies meaning that there's more kind of distinct lines, like the harder lines that make an object stand out more. Lower frequencies are kind of like the more broader aspects of an object. So if we filter out, yeah, did I see a question?
Yeah, I was just gonna say, like, when I take my glasses off, the one on the left looks like the one in the middle. So when we lose our vision or things like that, that all has to do with like this deterioration.
Yeah, it can. Yeah, right. So like, if we to take this theory into account, then that would account for if you lose your vision, then these different channels or these different cells that kind of parse out these different aspects of an image get kind of like out of whack. So again, so if we have this normal image of these penguins and we take out the high frequency stuff, meaning the sharp lines, then we would see this. We would see more of the low frequency stuff. And so some cells or some channels in the visual cortex are more selective to processing the lower frequency stuff. Now here is the same image, but we took out all the low frequency. So low frequencies, right, meaning kind of like the broader aspects of things, and we're left with more of the hard lines, more of the high frequency stuff. So we have, the theory suggests that there are some cells that are more selective to responding to like the high frequency stuff. And together, it composes a normal image in the brain, at least. Does that make sense? This is just one theory. Yeah. Yeah, so it seems like at least this one is a bit more correct, and I'll show you why in terms of the evidence I'll talk about in terms of the different pathways. This seemed to make a little bit more sense because, right, we look at complex objects every day. So if you take into account, you know, if you look at this, then that means we have to have receptive fields that can identify every single type of shape, every type of object, and that's kind of not the case. So, and I'll explain this by why the spatial frequency theory is maybe a little bit more correct, because as I mentioned, the first kind of like main stop for all the visual information is in the V1 or the occipital lobe, right? But information that goes into the occipital lobe will then project out to other areas for further processing. So for example, this is the back or the posterior of a primate brain, and this is all color-coded to show like V1, and there's all the way up to V5. So for example, we have information coming in from the retina through the optic nerve. Some go on to the superior colliculus, and some go on to the lateral geniculate nucleus, which then goes to V1. In V1, there are other pathways that can project out too. So for example, V2 and V4, and the inferior temporal cortex. Inferior meaning the lobe. Temporal meaning the temporal lobe or temporal cortex, so the IT. some of the information gets routed to from V1 to V2 and V4 and the IT to process like the form of an object, like the overall form, which kind of has to do with like high frequency stuff in the previous theory. Some information gets routed to V5. So this is also the medial temporal area, which is right here. So medial, remember, more middle, temporal, medial temporal lobe. And this area specifically processes motion perception. So V2, which is the cortical structure that's like right next to V1, it's also part of the occipital lobe, V2 right here. This area overlaps a lot with V1, not only in real estate, but also the functions too. But specifically, V2 processes information that kind of fills in the gaps when you look at things. So for example, when you look at this object, and for those of you who have taken like intro to psych, you've probably seen like these illusions before, where you have these different shapes, but your brain kind of fills in the gap, like, okay, there's this white triangle here, and it fills in the gap with this black outline triangle too, right? So V2 kind of helps process and fills in the gaps of these information. V4, the cells in that area, which I'll show you here, V4 is right here, next to V2. They respond specifically, or they respond stronger, to kind of like circular objects and also color perception too. And also the cells in the inferior temporal lobe, or inferior temporal cortex, respond to complex patterns, just like this, and forms, including things that we have learned to recognize over time. So you can kind of see how all these regions contribute to that spatial frequency theory in terms of dissecting out different parts of what you're looking at. And of course, receptive fields, especially in the inferior temporal lobe, they develop through neuroplasticity as you learn to recognize visual objects. So there are other visual areas that go beyond those V areas, right? So here's V1, here's V5. Some important areas to note are the frontal eye fields, which right here, part of the frontal cortex, which is right next to the precentral gyrus, right? This area is important for focusing your visual attention and also voluntary eye movement. So that's why it's called like the frontal eye field. So this, in combination with the superior colliculus, is involved in eye movements and helps you focus and direct your attention. It's just this little spot right here. The prefrontal cortex, certain areas of the prefrontal cortex, as well as the fusiform gyrus, which is on the temporal lobe, specifically responds to faces. So there is a condition called prosopagnosia where you have the inability to recognize faces, even though it's a face that you come to learn and know. There is a condition where you just can't recognize the face, and that's what that is. So usually prefrontal cortex and fusiform gyrus are defunct and results in prosopagnosia. In terms of the other two pathways, the two main pathways for visual processing is the parietal, or actually the dorsal pathway and the ventral pathway. So we see here, we start at the V1, right, because that's like the first main stop, and then it projects onto V2 and the medial temporal lobe, and then in the parietal lobe, and that's the dorsal pathway. And this is responsible for, or this stream is responsible for determining the location of objects, kind of like the where pathway is what it's often referred to. And then the other pathway from V1 goes to V2, and then V4 in the temporal lobe. And this is the ventral pathway, or the ventral processing stream. And this is more involved in identifying what the objects are. So you can see that visual information comes in, recognizing objects, but then they project this information, goes out to other brain regions to kind of trigger those associations of what we've learned these objects to be. And that's what we're able to recognize objects. So this is just another general schematic, the dorsal pathway and the ventral pathway. And then this is this shows activation, I believe, in a monkey. This is the anterior, that's a posterior brain. and the different activation depending on the ventral pathway or the dorsal pathway. So that's the evidence that we have to show that these two complex pathways are involved in processing and recognizing these different visual information. Any questions on that? Yeah?
Does this information also eventually make its way to like the limbic system, to like the process that emotionally?
Yeah, for sure. So the comment was, would this information eventually make its way to like the limbic system to process emotion? And yes, I'm sure we've all had the example of, you know, we smell like some kind of food that reminds us of our childhood, right? And that triggers like a response both emotionally and physically. And so this is how this is all related together. So it definitely makes its way and triggers these different emotions and physiological responses. Yeah, I think that's it. Oh, I think this may be the last one. So there's also evidence, not just from animals, but from humans, to show that these pathways are actually real. And so we have data, not we in my lab, but science has data, showing that in patients with damage to the ventral stream, like the ventral lateral occipital cortex, you guys should be able to know how to pinpoint this now, which is right here, right? Ventral meaning below or towards the bottom, lateral meaning towards the side, and so these are lateral views of the brain. And so that's a ventral lateral occipital cortex. So when patients have damage to this area, they have problems identifying objects. And then conversely, there's something called optic ataxia, which is when there's damage to the posterior parietal cortex, which is one of the further streams on the dorsal pathway, one of the last stops. When you have damage to that, it produces something called optic ataxia, where you have difficulty kind of adjusting your vision to reach for an object, right? Determining where an object is. Yeah? That's part of depth perception, yeah. Mm-hmm. So your depth perception can actually be blunted because, as I mentioned here, the dorsal pathway is associated with assessing the location of an object. So both your binocular vision is required for depth perception, but also your dorsal stream has to be fully functional in order to gauge where it is. And then, for example, if you're reaching for an object, then that information will give you relay to the motor cortex to adjust your, for example, your hand reaching for it. Yeah. Does that make sense? Yes?
So like when you're intoxicated or when someone's intoxicated?
Yes, as I was this weekend.
And they're like depth perception is off? Is it like, I don't know, really this
happening? Yeah, absolutely, absolutely you can. As I mentioned with the other question, your binocular vision is also required for that. So when you're intoxicated, alcohol is a GABA agonist. GABA aminobutyric acid is primarily inhibitory neurotransmitter. So when you drink a lot of alcohol, a lot of GABA goes in, starts shutting down functions, and that's what can be responsible for our vision. So okay, reminders. This week we're back to your regularly scheduled discussion sections. And then the quiz for this week's discussion will cover lesson 2A and 2B. And that was your password for the midterm, by the way. So, okay, guys. Have a good one. My office hours will be today at 2 to 3, so feel free to show up. I don't know if this mic is working anymore. But. All right, guys.